Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. As a reminder to those that are joining us live, make sure and scroll down to the bottom of the show page. You'll see the chat room there. If you have some observations during the show or if there's a question you'd like for us to address our guest that you don't think we're going to get to, that's a great place to put it because we'll both be monitoring that during the show, and we'll try to fold in those ideas as we go forward. And if you're new to the show or if you want to catch up on some previous shows, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio. Now let's get on with the show. We all know that the Chief of Naval Operations' number one priority, thank goodness, is war fighting. But how do leaders have the ability to give the amount of focus they need to do that inside of the limitation of a 24-hour day? And we all operate under certain administrative and operational chains of command, and everybody seems to be pulling at the attentions, needing metrics, needing to write 101 awards by the end of the quarter. All these different things can pull and distract leaders away, not just from taking care of their sailors, but focusing ultimately on why we all exist and wear the uniform is to prepare to engage as the National Command Authority desires us to. And there's an ongoing battle that's nothing new in the military service because one person's administrative burden is another person's critical requirement. And it could also be something that has a little bit of job security for that individual or is something that's very important to them, but is it really something that's important to the larger organization? And a smart organization is always looking as these requirements accumulate over time, and now then you need to look back and see what really is value added and what really could probably be lived without. And we have an initiative that the Navy's undertaken recently that we're going to discuss today, and we've got just the right person on board. Our guest for the first half hour of the show to discuss this is going to be Rear Admiral Herman Shalansky. He's the director of the Assessment Division, OPNAV N81. And specifically, we're going to discuss where he's been the point man on. That's the crowdsourcing initiative looking at reducing administrative distractions, nice little abbreviation RAD, and how this program is looking forward to removing those non-value-added distractions away from sailors and the leaders who are trying to do what they need to do. Rear Admiral Shalansky, welcome to MidRats.
Well, thanks, Al. It's really a pleasure to be here, and look forward to telling you a little bit about what we're doing and hopefully answer some questions from the fleet out there.
Yes, sir. I really appreciate the opportunity. And just to tee the ball up here, I thought, you know, a lot of our listeners may be vaguely aware of it. Maybe they've seen the article in Navy Times or have seen it online. But the initiative Reducing Administrative Distraction, what was the genesis of this latest program going forward? And what makes it different than other efforts in the past to help address that administrative overhead that we see?
Well, this effort really began with the CNO, and as you know, when he took over, Admiral Greener talked about warfighting first. So in his travels around to visit the fleet, he got feedback on about his term warfighting first. So a lot of the sailors were saying, you know, we love to do warfighting first, we want to do warfighting first, but we're bogged down, we're tied up with all this administrivia, so to speak, and you know, we can't get the time to focus on really the important things, the war fighting stuff, and you know, the leadership piece, that on the deck plate leadership that the CNO likes to talk about, seemed to be pulling them away and really absorbing their day. So the CNO at the last flag officer conference, that's just been about 3 months now, I suspect, asked you know, talked about this to the flag officers, and Admiral Richardson, he's the four-star, he's Naval Reactors, volunteered to take this project on and to kind of put it somewhere where we can investigate, number one, what these distractions are and how do we solve them in our Navy. So I happened to be in between jobs, and Admiral Richardson asked me to help him out. So we started up this group, and it really took place down at the Naval Warfare Development Center. And you all may know that down there they have what they call an innovation cell. And the CNO put this cell together, comprised of a bunch of junior officers, some senior, some petty officers throughout the fleet, that are learning to think in new ways and to help bring new ways of thinking to the Navy. So I tapped them for some ideas and kind of got a kernel of their leaders down there and sailors and officers to help me stand up kind of the concept, where do we go with this? And really the first thing we wanted to do was to go out and find out what are the distractions. You know, you can go around and you can ask a lot of people. So the traditional way would be, let's do a survey. And that's not a bad way of doing things, because a survey can give you analytical data, it can give you percentages, and it can give you a way to look and see which are the most important or the most thought of distractions. Well, to get a survey going in the United States Navy means you have to have quite a bit of money. You have to get, it takes you probably 90 days to get approval, and then they may, typically they told me about 60 days to get it set up, and then you have to send the survey out, and you have to get the results back, and then you have to analyze it. So there's probably another 60 days if you want to do it the fastest type of survey that they have. So you're looking at, I was looking about 9 months worth of waiting to even get the basic results, which... In this fast-paced world, you know, we wanted to get something moving right away. So the innovation team mentioned to me that they had started a type of website, and they were using it for an electronic warfare game that they were doing throughout the fleet. And it's a type of crowdsourcing, but their website wasn't quite mature enough to handle what we thought would be the volume of people calling in. So we went to a commercial site led by IdeaScale, and you can Google it online. IdeaScale had, and there are several of them that do this type of programmatics, but they were available, and they were able to set us up in 2 weeks. We did it out on the World Wide Web. We did not do an NMCI because of the reasons I just told you about. And we were up and running within a couple weeks, and then started getting the inputs from the sailors. So it's not just a blog, it's not just a post, it's more of a social media. It's very similar to a Facebook page. People can post, but even more important, you can categorize the distractions, which we did, and then there's areas for people to comment on and say, hey, I think you're right, let me tell you about, you know, my experience with this distraction, and then people vote on it. So you can give them thumbs up, thumbs down. And that way we were able to crowdsource. That's a crowdsourcing technique. It allows the most thought of distractions rise to the top. And so from that, we were able to glean out of this, you know, the raw data, the analytics, which are automatically done on this also, by the way. So you can, we were getting weekly updates on the percentage of the people, the high number votes, the ones that were mostly emotional about some of the distractions. And that way allowed us to track and be at the end of the month, our first phase of our program, to really get gleam out of that and the distractions that were thought of in the fleet. And we have about 1,300 of them. And so now we're moving into phase two of our program, and we're in a three-phase program here. Phase one, of course, was to gather the data. Phase two is to find solution sets, and phase three is an implementation phase, each of them about a month. And so this first kind of go-around on administrative distractions we hope to achieve and solve, you know, a good handful of them. Now, we don't think we're going to be able to get them all done in the first 3 months. So this is an ongoing program. So this is kind of like a cogwheel. At the end of the first cycle, we'll start the cycle again and then reinvigorate the ones, the distractions we weren't able to get to. So that's where we are today. It's a great concept, it's a great website. I had never seen it before. It turns out that many of the major industries, IBM, and several of the other major, you know, Fortune 500 companies have shifted really from an email system to this what they call social business, when using a business sense as opposed to crowdsourcing social media in their day-to-day communication. So someone can post ideas, thoughts, you know, way ahead projects, and people then can comment on it. So what's really valuable about this? Well, number one, we wanted to hear from the sailors, I mean all the sailors. So what's that E3 out there? What's he thinking? What's hurting his head? What's the chief doing? What's hurting the chief's head? What's the young officers, the JOs in the wardroom? What are they thinking about this? So everyone has an opportunity to participate, and everyone can comment. And it's what we call knowledge sharing. So you can easily see how across the continuum of the Navy, you know, thoughts can get shared rather quickly as opposed to our stovepipe methodology that we typically use to get ideas across. So if you have a training session, which we just recently did, so we had a stand down on SAPR training, and you meet in a room and people talk about ideas and they put their ideas together and someone records them, and then these ideas get sent up to the TICOM, and then up to the fleet, and then they get put together. And then at some point, they'll probably take all these good ideas and say, hey, here's the top 10 best ideas, and they're going to push them down to the fleet for practice. Well, all that time that takes to put those thoughts together in this type of a website, in this crowdsourcing, that's done instantaneously. So the ideas are immediately shared. The good ideas immediately rise to the top, and we have great visibility on what they are. So that's where we are today. We've, like I said, 1,300 distractions. We're looking at some low-hanging fruit, some that we can solve fairly quickly. We want to obviously not spend a lot of money because we do happen to be in a budget crunch. We are looking at, you know, getting together the folks that have written in on the website now to help us find solutions. We picked five narrow focus studies, we call them campaigns, for sailors to write into to tell us if they have a good solution for. And we're hoping to gather some information. We've already received many replies and some really good ideas so far, and we're looking forward to really refining them and turning them out to the fleet. Now, I'll tell you one other thing that sort of came out of this that we weren't quite expecting was that if you had asked me about a month and a half ago, what are we doing in the realm of 3M, I would have said, hey, no one's working on that. Or what are we doing to, you know, update our NavFit programs or all the websites that our sailors have to go to? I had no visibility in it. Either does the fleet. But it turns out that there are people that were actually working. They have some programmatics going. And so the other really good spinoff of this was that all these participants, whether they're down at MilPERS or up at N1 or down at NAVC or NAVAIR, started to read the comments that were coming in on the website. And they took those comments and then plugged them back into their programmatics to make sure that they were answering those questions, to make sure that they were taking care of those issues that the sailors identified. And, by the way, what it did, it also lent visibility to the fleet that, you know what, things really are going on out there. We just didn't have visibility on it. And now we can say what's happening and feed that back to the sailors to let them know that, hey, the Navy really is concerned about these things, and we really are going to try to solve them. How's that for a quick opening?
That'll work. Eagle One.
That's a very good quick opening. You've answered a lot of the questions that I was going to ask. So, but what kind of signal-to-noise ratio do you get out of this? I mean, have there been some just totally off-the-wall things that you've discounted, and how do you weigh those things and toss out what are clearly jokes or bad ideas and search for the true nuggets?
Well, that's part of the beauty of this type of social media. The crowd does it for me. I don't have to throw anything out. So someone that's kind of off the wall, they just vote them down. And, you know, you'll get a negative 10, negative 20, negative 100 if they don't like the idea or if it's just not relevant. We still look at those. We still want to know what people are saying. I read them all. But, you know, some of them weren't relevant to the administrative distraction. Some of them were good ideas. I think someone wrote in they didn't want to be sprayed anymore with pepper, you know, you know, when they do that for the training piece of it. But that wasn't relevant to administrative distraction. But, hey, I'm with them. I don't want to be sprayed with pepper spray either. So those are some of the ideas. Some people wrote in about flag galleys, and some people talked about cutting the grass and why are we cutting the grass, or why are we even growing lawn out here in China Lake or something like that. So some of those are, they're not bad ideas, they just weren't relevant to what we were doing. So as I said, the crowd sources them out, and then the other ones that everyone can relate to rise to the top.
I guess kind of the online version of the open question session at Captain's Call. You know, you never know what you're going to have come out of left field. I wanted one of the advantages of a long format show is you're able to do long quotes here. Because one thing that intrigued me about this whole concept is, you know, speaking of mowing yards, and I kind of touched on in the beginning, is the fact that this is really an ongoing challenge. And I want to use a long quote here to lead into my next question for you. A friend of the show and a guest on a previous show here, Lieutenant Commander B.J. Armstrong, he put out a book this summer, 21st Century Mahan. And he, right out of the box, one thing he did, and it was really, I can recommend nothing if nothing else, the first chapter on this. BJ dove into the writings that Mahan had on management, administration, and naval leadership. And I'll begin kind of a long quote. The first part of this was BJ's commentary leading up to a Mahan quote. BJ said, quote, "Mahan tells his reader that there is a natural conflict between the military officer and the administrator, and that can be a strength of the system. He also writes," and this is Mahan here, quote, "the military man having to do the fighting considers it the chief necessity. The administrator equally naturally tends to think the smooth running of the machine the most admirable quality. Both are necessary, but the latter cannot obtain under the high pressure of war unless in peace the contingency of war has dictated its system. There is a quaint, well-worn story, which yet may be new to some readers, of an administrator who complained that his office was working admirably until war came and threw everything out of gear," unquote, from Mahan. And BJ boils down the rest, because for people who have read Mahan in the original, it can be a little bit of a challenge. So a little bit more of a quote on BJ's commentary that I think really boils down the rest of what Mahan has to say. And this is from BJ. "Mahan believed that when given the opportunity, the smooth operation of the essential bureaucratic task of the administration would overwhelm military considerations and the necessity of warfare. For that reason, military officers, especially those on staff duty, would need to constantly guard against the idea that the economical working of the office was more important than the impact on the ability of combat forces to do their job. Mahan believed that it would take long for officers in staff positions to be corrupted by the civil administrative system. Time served on staff duty away from combat units," quote, "tended to deaden the intimate appreciation of naval exigencies," unquote. "As a result, officers need to ask themselves constantly if they were helping deploy naval forces to be ready for combat or if they were helping the administrative system to run more smoothly and acceptably to civilians and politicians." He reminded officers that the, quote, "habit of the armchair easily prevails over that of the quarterdeck as it is more comfortable," unquote. So thank you for indulging the long quote. So that was written 105 years ago. And we could all nod our head during the course of our career feeling many of the same things. So the question here, and one thing I was wondering how y'all have addressed this issue, obviously when we get through with all the phases of the present reducing administrative distractions, what is the follow-on? How do we do follow-up? And is there a look at, you know, when is the next iteration of this process? When would be a good time to back up again and said, since we've mowed the yard, how high have the weeds grown, and do we need to do this cycle again?
Yeah, that's a great question, and by the way, a great quote. And, you know, I think for the warriors that have come off of sea duty and are sitting in the office, they feel it all the time. You know, and the good ones, they do reminisce about the bridge wing. I certainly do. I keep looking for the bridge wing so I can go out and have a good cigar with the water running under, but it just doesn't happen at the Pentagon. So, you know, you have to keep your focus to make sure that you are doing things ultimately for the warrior. You know, we will have to mow the lawn quite a few times on this one. And the other piece that I think we need to do and we need to look at is who's the gate guard? You know, who's the guy that says, hey, we're just not going to do that. You know, it's just a bunch of, it's too much, and the value added to the fleet is just not good. And a lot of that's in the training realm. And we're seeing that type of focus being put together right now. In fact, I think one of the great things that have come from this study is that down at NETSI, our training command, in Pensacola, they're putting together a flag-level planning board for training that's going to look at all the training requirements, all the GMT, and they're going to categorize them. And, you know, one of the things we're looking at is why do we have to do an hour of training on our credit card every month or something like that? You know, what's the importance to the warrior, and how much is, you know, why is that such an important thing as opposed to, like for me as an aviator, you know, what my flight survival training, I only do that once every 4 years as a requirement. And you look at the balance and you go, whoa, you know, that something's off balance there. Why have to do it so much? So now we're looking and setting up a process to stop the nonsense, to put a halt to it before it gets to the fleet. So I'm optimistic. You know, we still have to put it in. So, yeah, we need to mow the grass. We need to always look at it. And then we need a gate guard to stop new stuff from flowing in. And we're looking at both of those. I think this mowing the grass is going to take a year or so just to get through the first 1,300 iterations easily, and maybe even longer. But as Admiral Richardson says, he said, you know, I'm going to be naval reactors. I'm here for 8 years, and I'm not going to drop this. So I'm going to make this work. If it takes a couple of years, we're going to get through it. And, you know, we did this before. We tried to do this before many years ago, and I forget exactly the date or why it didn't work, or if it did, why we're back here. But I think we have to look at where we are today in terms of, you know, this is a modern era. I mean, everyone's got a cell phone. They've got iPads, you know, digitization and apps. And, you know, sailors are looking at stuff that comes out. People can develop an app. You know, in an hour, right? And so people go, why do I have to go to the base, stand in line for 45 minutes to an hour to register my car when, you know, there are apps that are already developed that can do that for you online? I don't have to go there. I can do all my banking from my iPhone. I can, you know, take a picture of my check, you know, write it into Navy Federal Credit Union, and it's deposited. Why do we still have to go through, you know, the 1980s processes that today can easily be solved with a little bit of innovation and modernization? And I think that's why it didn't work as well in the past, where I think and I'm hoping, you know, today we can make this stuff work better. So we'll see. Well, I'm the first mower out there, so I'll let you know how it goes at the end.
Well, as you walk through this process, and let me make sure I got it. You've gathered these ideas, 1,300 suggestions or whatever you ideas. You're developing solution sets, and you're crowdsourcing the solution sets too. And are there rewards for people as we go through this process where they're going to get money or some other kind of, I mean, like the old Penny Sug program that I remember from my youth? And who carries out the implementation? Is this something that's going to be directed down from CNO to people saying, here's, you know, here, Admiral, we've discovered this is a problem in your group, and here's a, you know, here's a suggested solution set. How's that going to work?
Well, that's, yeah, so we are crowdsourcing solutions right now on the web on NavyRAD.ideascale. And we've narrowed the focus down because this is sort of a trial run. How well will this work? And besides the website, there is a group, there's a network, I call it our network, for the RAD team. And this network is comprised of volunteers. You know, picture the Navy and, you know, one of those organization charts with all the lines coming down. Now take your yellow marker and draw horizontally through the, you know, that org chart. And we've got people from each of the places in the Navy that are on this team. And so they're the brains that I go to help take a look at the solution sets. And, by the way, to participate on solution set panels. And also to help come up with, you know, who are the folks that really deserve recognition, whether it's a coin, you know, or just a letter, or hopefully some money. Benny Sugg, yeah. Have you ever tried to get a Benny Sugg suggestion through the administrative burden to get that done? I mean, it takes about six different papers and about a year process to get even to get it there, unfortunately. We're trying to also eliminate that and trying to streamline it. So we do want to try to get some money out there. We have to see where we are at the end of the day with the budget, but that's the goal. It is to reward people. It is to reward sailors, even if it's just to get their name up in front of the CNO and say, hey, here's a young sailor that had a great idea, and he's really helping the Navy, you know, do better things.
One of the things I like about the program, and kind of I wanted to back off a bit and kind of get big pixel about it, get near the top of the hour, and one of the interesting concepts about it is when you look back at interwar periods, they've always been, in many ways, unique opportunities for organizations to be able to think critically, to think forward, to make adjustments. The period between World War I and World War II was probably one of the better interwar periods for thinking, looking forward. The period between World War II and Korea probably wasn't our finest time for thinking and looking forward. And I kind of look at this as an organizational effort to be a learning institution, to be a thinking institution, and try to address one of the burrs under the saddle that everybody feels. And in a larger sense, and we kind of touched on it with the last question, but as an organization, are we looking at ways, not just in RAD, but in a larger sense, to increase the conversation, to bring in more ideas and more thoughts? And do we really have a culture, or what are some things that we can do to help establish or refine our culture that encourages thoughts and ideas to be publicly put out there that maybe are a little bit painting outside the lines, maybe a little bit messing with somebody else's rice bowl, job security, and pet project? Is there additional things that we're thinking about doing to help build that type of culture, not just of innovation, but really of critical thought and looking back and looking close at how we do things and asking that question, is this really the right way to do it?
Well, I'd like to say yes. There's no big move or talk about that right now that I can see. I will say that this type of website, if we were to ever embed it in NMCI or whatever next-gen web looks like, that it has the potential of doing that. Because you can post ideas, and then the ideas can, you know, are there for all to see and comment on and start discussions. I think it's a very powerful tool. And if we want to do that, if we want to create a book at the way we do things, this is a great way to do it. And I think it also has the potential. There was there's a couple officers that work in Admiral Richardson's office. There's a lieutenant commander there, very forward-thinking. And he said, you know, sir, we need to get this type of thought process on the SIPR side also. So we can talk warfare, we can talk tactics, and we can start putting out, you know, discussions about how we do warfare now. You know, what are our avenues today? Look around. Tell me, what avenues does a young lieutenant in any warfare specialty have of saying, hey, we're going about this wrong? You know, the way we deploy our ships, you know, our tactics, you know, here's a better way of doing things. There is no avenue. The Naval Warfare Development Center is starting to, you know, put together a website that allows people to write in. But, you know, you look at, you know, we have Navy proceedings. It's a great way to do it, but it's unclassified. You can't get into some of the details. So we really need a classified way to talk warfare. And myself, I'm a big war gamer. When I was a strike group commander, I like to game through things because it puts you in a scenario and it makes you think and it makes all the warfare commanders start questioning the way we're going to do business, because there's no formal training until you're going through the FRTP process of working with other ships and airplanes and eventually submarines. Do you actually get that full battle picture, that full, you know, tactical, bordering operational, bordering on the strategic level? And we need that. I am a big believer that if we were to get this going, we would have a tremendous response from the junior officers that are really thinking about warfare, specifically tactics, interoperability, capabilities. You know, up in my new job in the assessment division, you know, we look at, you know, you have someone that says, hey, we need a missile that can do X. And then people go out and they look for the technology or they develop the technology. But again, it's very stovepiped. It'd be nice to open this up to the full spectrum of the intelligence that, you know, runs the full gamut of our Navy, the diversity that our Navy brings. We're hardly tapping into that talent, and this is a way to do it. And I tell you, I'm a big believer, and again, very optimistic that someday we'll be able to do that.
Well, it sounds like a terrific start to getting the Navy to join the 21st century as far as some of these crowdsourcing ideas and the concept that all of us together as a collective mind can come up with solutions to problems we haven't even identified a lot of times until after something like this comes along and get a chance to brainstorm through it. And I really would like to thank you, Admiral, for taking the time to come on our show today. It's been very interesting. I look forward to hearing more about RAD in the future. Anything you'd like to add here to us as we let you go?
Well, thanks for the opportunity to talk about it, and for the sailors that are out there listening, and my brother officers. You know, it's the best we can do as a Navy is how much you participate and how much you care about making our Navy better. So there's an opportunity out there. It's one on idea scale, NavyRAD.ideascale, and look forward to seeing what you have to say and other ideas to help us, you know, be a better Navy. So thanks for the opportunity.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure having you on there. And just a reminder to everybody, our guest has been Rear Admiral Herman Shalansky. He is OPNAV N81. And for those that are active duty and reserves, if you haven't had a chance to go over to the website, one more time, it's NavyRAD.ideascale.com, NavyRAD.ideascale.com. Join the conversation. Wish you the best of luck, Admiral.
Great. Thanks very much.
And now for everybody, we're going to go shift over to our end of the summer review. This is kind of free swim, free form, free ideas. If you have something in the chat room, which actually I want to kick things off on, and honor to our long distance regular from Turkey. If there are some topics that have rolled up this summer that you would like to see Eagle One and I pontificate about, you'll get what you pay for as far as the value of the ideas goes. Please let us know. But I want to kick it off on one thing we've been teasing our friend from Turkey about. He is right. There is it's always, in the Chinese sense, it's always been an interesting time to be a Turk. And, of course, what we're referring to, and one thing that I know Eagle One and I have talked about offline a few times, has been the situation in Syria right now. My baseline, and I do defer to our friends in Turkey. I know there's been a lot of talk. If people don't, on Twitter, yes, you can find both Eagle One and I both on Twitter if you wanted to look us up. But I've enjoyed looking a little bit sideways at some of Susan Rice and Samantha Power's tweets over the last few days, Eagle One, that just validates exactly the concerns y'all have heard me mention before. I'm not a fan of RTP, requirement to protect. They do seem to be reinforcing that opinion where, for some reason, it's America's job to interject itself everywhere that we don't approve of things. I think our Syria's neighbor to the north, Turkey, if they don't see the problem being enough that the second largest land army in NATO doesn't feel the need to cross the border to enforce them, and if the Turks ever did, I think we should 100% back them. No boots on the ground, but there's lots we could do to help the Turks that we absolutely should. But either one, I don't see the U.S. national interest of sitting themselves between two jerks who are beating the snot out of each other when all they're going to do is turn their hits on us. What am I missing, Eagle One? Why should we be putting ourselves in the middle of that ridiculous country known as Syria?
You know, I don't have an answer for that because I think if they're, you know, if you're a humanitarian intervention kind of person, then you're easily manipulated by various news things. And I think that to a certain extent, the administration has shown somewhat a cautious approach to this nerve gas or whatever kind of gas apparently was used by somebody in trying to avoid being rolled into getting involved in a situation that we probably could have done something useful several months ago, but now what are we going to do? We're not going to put troops on the ground. We're going to send more cruise missiles and bomb people. And if so, how do you know you're going to bomb the right people? And you know, you called it right. We discussed it before. We've got Saudi Arabia and Hezbollah and Iran and Russia and a whole bunch of other people in this ball of wax. And I'm not sure we want to get our toe dipped into this particular puddle of water.
Now, and if you look at the type of fighting that's going on over there, I think it was Reuters did a survey. Like 60% of the American public was no. I think 12 or 13 was yes. And, of course, you had the stuff in the squishy middle. Beyond the strategic long-term excuses or reasons that people may want to do that, I just don't think the taxpaying public or even those in military have any desire to step in the middle of Aleppo between a bunch of pulverized buildings and tell everybody to behave. It's just an excuse to get a bunch of people killed for no reason. And I think you hit on one of the perfect examples, you know, the old cliche that when your enemy is destroying themselves, whatever you do, don't get in their way. And if an Iran proxy wants to beat the snot out of an Al-Qaeda proxy, then so be it. And it's really not our job in any event to really get involved in it in any way, shape, and form. I think it's been unfortunate that you have people like John McCain, who I think should know better. But if the U.S. government...
You could have stopped right there.
Yeah, yeah.
Unfortunate.
I think there's more to follow here, but the poison gas thing, let me, okay, first of all, reach over under your desk and get your tinfoil hat and put it on. Put it on real firmly. Like, I don't want this to bleed into your brain or anything. But I tweeted this out this weekend, and a couple people kind of hit on it. I've said it before. But if I'm in a life or death struggle with somebody, and the person I'm fighting, everybody hates, but they hate me too. But everybody is saying, if that person does one thing, then I'm going to take your side. But that person won't do that one thing that will make everybody hate him more than they hate me. If I can create a situation that makes it look like he did that, that's really an advantage on my part. And both sides of this equation have no problem killing their own people to achieve a goal. So even if there was a gas attack somewhere, I don't think anybody can make an assumption who did it or who didn't for one reason or another and use that as an excuse to start pummeling one side or the other. I just think, again, going back to my initial point, I will defer to the Turks. If it's not worth them crossing the border, I don't think it's worth us.
Yeah, I mean, we've got three allies in the area. We've got Israel, Jordan, and Turkey. And if Turkey wants to call on us to help them out as a NATO country, and the place where I lived for a few years, I would be happy to give them any kind of assistance they would need. Jordan, I hope we're giving aid to help them handle the refugee issue they're facing down there with the Syrians. But we have to be really careful. Al Qaeda did not get killed when Osama bin Laden died,
no.
And we see the black Al Qaeda flags flying in Egypt. We see them in Syria, and I'm not sure that as bad as Assad is, and I think our Turkish friend has said this in the chat room, as bad as our Turkish friend is, we do not know what would replace him that might be even worse. And after the histories that we've seen in Afghanistan and a few other places, we have to be really, really careful about who we would side with in these places. And if they want to knock each other out, as you just said, I'm not too disinclined to let them have as much fun as they want with each other as long as they're not doing anything to us. Or our good friends and allies ask for help.
And I feel no need to expend blood or treasure to help enforce the Sykes-Picot treaty after World War I that carved up the Middle East anyway. I've had a couple people go, well, the country may break up. Okay. If the Christians and the Alawites in the Northwest want to have their own little Lebanon-sized country so they don't have to deal with the Looney Tunes down in the river valleys, and if the Kurds over in northeast Syria say, we just want to have West Turkestan here and have a nice day, okay, fine. Self-determination. It worked for the Czechs and the Slovaks. It worked for the Croats, the Kosovars, the Bosnians, the Serbs, the Montenegrins, and who the hell else from the former Yugoslavia decided they wanted their own country. If it goes that direction, self-determination is a wonderful thing. Why not? Won't bother me in the least bit.
Yeah, I think we sometimes assume that things that were stable sort of as they were, that Syria was a country since it was created out of thin air, for World War I, as you say, that we somehow owe them an obligation for them to continue their existence as they are. I don't see that. I see that this is another case of a tyrannical government that has held together a lot of disparate groups, sort of like Yugoslavia was under Tito and his guys. That really ought to be independent, and the only reason they were cobbled into a country is somebody arbitrarily drew lines on a map someplace. And I'm not sure that that's the best way to. And you're not going to create this kind of omelet without breaking a few eggs. And as long as you're somebody else's eggs, I'm really in favor of staying the heck out of this thing.
Yeah, and it's funny how you get the echoes of history in this whole thing when you have all the announcement this week of U.S. naval forces moving over to the Eastern Med, and the Russians say, I see your destroyer and cruiser, and I raise you a cruiser and three frigates and a Rapushka. I'm reminded of what was once called Smyrna. It's now called Izmir, back in the 1920s, when you had an international naval armada off the coast telling the Turks to leave the Greek citizens alone. And most people know how that worked out as heads floated down the river. It would be very interesting to see if we don't reach another situation like that, though I don't think because of the terrain there. There's a reason why in the mountains of Syria you have a rather quirky Shia sect, Christians, and Druze that survive to this day. It's because it's built for defense. So it would be very difficult, I think, for the Sunni rebels to sweep everybody to the sea like the Turks did with the coastal Greeks in the 1920s. But I think that's probably what's going to want to take place. Nations are going to stick their fleets out there because the great thing is about fleets. They can try to create effects ashore, but if they decide it's not worth it, you can always pull anchor and go home. Call no harm, no foul, evacuate a few people to make you feel better, and then leave. Whereas when you put boots on the ground, or if you put nowadays aircraft across the beach who get shot down, he has some POWs, you lose that national flexibility. So I would kind of counsel everybody to take a powder if you start seeing a multinational fleet off the coast. I guess a lot of people just showing the flag and creating opportunities to create effects if required, but I don't think it's necessarily a precursor to anything that's really going to create huge effects more than within eyesight of the beach.
Well, all that having been said, and with my views on humanitarian intervention being well known, is there a situation in which Assad or some other organization did something so horrendous that we would not be unable to stick our nose into it?
What are my red lines? I think we've done a pretty good job of establishing one red line. I think it's pretty clear, and that's Jordan. If he wanted to expand it anywhere, though, I think Jordan's biggest problem, I know the USAID and other non-governmental organizations are helping with some of the refugees problems, not just in Turkey, but also in Jordan. That's probably the biggest problem. I think if it's kept inside of the Syrian borders, that's fine. I don't think a ophthalmologist, which people forget, unlike his father, who achieved power through godfather-esque activities, not unlike his neighbor Saddam, that Bashar Assad's an ophthalmologist, he's a doctor, and he took this position based upon how he was born and the obligations to tribe and religion and family and everything else. I don't think he is of the mindset where he's going to be so stupid as to expand it. I don't think he's of the mindset where he's going to drench entire valleys with gas. I think he's a little smarter than that. I think he knows that he's a very close to assuming room temperature, but I wouldn't think he's going to do something stupid. I really don't. I think the opposition, though, is stupid enough. And I'm speaking of the Al-Qaeda and the international fighters that are coming in on the Sunni rebel side. You can say what you want to about the Iranians, but I think the Iranians are smart enough to not do something as stupid as to invite, best case scenario for me, probably one of the worst case for them, to bring a bunch of aircraft striking all of their weapons depots. I think the forces are so closely engaged at the tactical level, there's not much that we can do from the air. A lot of people are getting excited about possible TLAM strikes. All I would counsel everybody to do is review your recent history of TLAM-only strikes. Very limited tactical and operational effects, and if they're done wrong, they could have significant negative strategic effects. So I think Assad has played this about as well as he could, and I'm not saying I'm a fan of Assad. I'm not a fan of anybody's in this equation, but I think he's not a Saddam Hussein. He's not a Muammar Gaddafi, He's not a Hosni Mubarak. He's an ophthalmologist who is doing this out of family obligation. I think that makes him a little bit of a different character to deal with.
Well, it's an interesting suggestion that if, you know, a country's internal affairs, even if we may not agree about how the country got put there, but a country's internal affairs used to be a line for the U.S. and most other nations. You know, we don't want to, you can do whatever you want inside your own borders. And we've kind of left that. But then in the last few years, we've said, no, and that's this whole HI, humanitarian intervention, or requirement to protect, or whatever you want to call it, that there are actions inside a nation that are so horrendous that there is some kind of international, there's viewed, at least argued, some kind of international obligation to come in and protect people. And the most, I guess the earliest indication that we didn't do that right, a lot of people were very unhappy with the reactions in Rwanda, even though that was sort of an internal thing. Now, how do we balance those things? Where's the magic balance from, you know, this isn't quite bad enough yet to we've got to do something because this is just genocide or whatever it turns out. Have you got any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, you used the G word, genocide. You know, let's look back at what happened in Rwanda. A friend of mine was a Belgian paratrooper, was there, has an interesting scar to show for it from a machete as well. You had the majority population, 80-20 in Rwanda, Hutu versus Tutsi. Anyway, not important. Within a very short period of time, in a very personal level, you had the majority go after a minority population and were slaughtering them wholesale. We're not talking lining a dozen prisoners against the wall and shooting them, which incidentally the rebels have been doing to their captured Syrian army soldiers and posting the videos quite proudly. We're talking about taking entire villages, putting them into mosques and burning them alive, doing things kind of along the lines of what the Serbs did in Srebrenica, where you take out 200 at a time, put a bullet in the back of their heads, get out another 200 at a time, put bullets in the back of their heads in the finest European tradition. I think that's different than an internal civil war that is very urban. When you have one force fighting another force block by block, you're going to kill a lot of civilians. I think we have to be careful how we judge civilian deaths that take place in the course of conflict. Within living memory, the U.S., have incinerated hundreds of thousands of civilians inside of a fortnight with non-nuclear weapons even. I'm not just talking about the nukes, because that's what happens in war. If you have a nation that's fighting for its survival, these things will happen. And are they pleasant? No. But do they justify a nation a third of a planet away landing its forces ashore to stop what cannot be stopped? This will have. Somebody wrote Friday, not the first person to write it, but I think it's a pretty good phrase. This has to burn itself out. And I think that's largely what we're going to see. And does that mean that hundreds of thousands of people may die in the course of the Civil War? Yeah, hundreds of thousands died in our Civil War. Civil wars are nasty. Millions died in China. Millions died in Russia. We were well into six figures in Rwanda as well. But that really wasn't a civil war. That was outright genocide. And I think we haven't seen that by the Syrian government, where they have rounded up all the Sunnis and have slaughtered them wholesale. I think you have some retail killing of civilians. I don't mean to sound callous, but that happens in all wars. American military has done that in wars. That happens sometimes. But I don't think we've reached the level of genocide, though some people have used that word. And it kind of torques me off, because I think genocide is a word that we need to be very careful how we define it. It's a strong word, but it's an important word. And when you call something genocide, it needs to be genocide, not massacre. There's a difference between massacre and genocide, and I don't think we have that in Syria.
Yeah, I'm interested in some of the examples that as I sit here and think of. You know, I mean the Cambodians under Pol Pot. I mean, would that have called for humanitarian intervention under today's rules? The Chinese and with the Mao Red Book Revolution, when they turned all the people out into the fields and you know, talking about millions of people dying and other unpleasantries, if under the HI standards that some people seem to espouse, that North Korea is a humanitarian intervention waiting to happen. But
yeah.
We've got to have some finer line. And you know, the president made a mistake, I think, in the Syrian case when he talked about his red line. You know, first thing is you may have a red line, but you got to be really careful if you're president of the United States about announcing something. It's like giving an order you know cannot or will not be obeyed. Why? Don't bother.
as a father, you appreciate the fact you cannot threaten your children unless you're planning to carry it out. Because the minute you make that threat and you don't carry it out, things are only going to get worse.
Oh, absolutely, and you know, I think that our Turkish friend has got another nice thing up in the chat room. He says, you know, that Iran, Israel, Russia, and others are all playing around in Syria, and I guess one of the questions would be whether there is some method to you know, if they want to spend their time and money, I guess we should just let them play in there. As long as it doesn't leave Syria's borders, maybe we should just, as you said, let it burn out. But what about that intervention from Iran and those guys?
Well, I think my favorite word in the English language, why? Why is Iran involved? I think Syria is like the only friend Iran has, and the Alawites are.
Their mothers like them.
That's very true. The Alawites are a quirky Shia clan. Clan is a strong word. Shia denomination, to use a Christian term. Tucked away, far away, isolated, people who follow Al-Qaeda and follow what happened in Iraq, that makes the wars of the Protestant Reformation look like a holiday. That's also, they're trying to keep their only friend. They have their co-religionists they're trying to back up. That's their window and their view to Europe. You also have to remember the Turkish people and the Persian people have a history as well. It's always nice to have close friends next to the border of one of your historical antagonists. I think there are natural reasons, three or four of them, why Iran is involved. Russia, part of me goes, this is one of the few places Russia can again try to assert itself after losing face in the Balkans so much.
Mediterranean port.
Yep, Tartus. Don't underestimate the value of Tartus to the Russians and the history of their desire to get into the Mediterranean, to get to warm water. There's lots of historical reasons why they want to back that up there. Israel, I always am very careful trying to think about Israel inside of an American context. Sometimes Israel lives in a tough, and they've got to do what they've got to do to stop those really impressive stockpiles of weapons that Syria has accumulated over the years from getting into the wrong hands, because Israel is a very small country, very advanced country. I do think, kind of an off subject here, but I think this experience in Syria should put an end to anybody, both inside and outside Israel, thinking of ever giving back to Golan Heights. I think that's going to be Israeli as long as Israel is a country now. That type of strategic debt.
What? You wouldn't cede the high ground?
You know, call it radical. call it a unique concept. Gee whiz, not to, and you got the water wars coming on. So yeah, people. If John Kerry ever says that again, somebody needs to hit the electronic switch and give him a zap from his training collar, because that's just silly.
Hey, we better wrap this up. We're running out of time here.
Well, and if anybody wants to catch our ramblings, we do go over the hour after it goes live here. But if we could have kind of a fire or rapid fire round, because I kicked off a subject that managed to chew up 30 minutes. Elon, what do you think is something that people are too distracted looking at other things right now from a national security perspective that people ought to take a second look at here as we go into fall?
I think the impact, the full impact of the sequestration on military expenditures needs to be very carefully examined, because some of what we've got going on is crying wolf about what the impact is, and some of it we need a good budget person to go in and say, look, you know, let's weed out these extraneous programs. Your blog has very good points about a lot of these programs that seem to be fully funded just to cause problems. And by that I mean the sexual impact things, the grievance industry of various kinds, whatever it's based on. They seem to be fully funded, and they distract from the primary mission of the service, which is to get ready to fight wars. And if you're busy getting ready to fight wars, you don't have a lot of time to have those other things interfere with your work, I think. I mean, one man's view. How about you?
Now, I keep looking for the green eyeshade guy to really explain all this, because I think there was a lot of hyperbole about the impact of sequestration, but it's a real issue. I mean, money talks. Where's the money? What is it going to? And you have to be able to prioritize things. You demonstrate what's important to you by what you put money towards. You also, I think, advertise how serious you are by those things that you spend money on that you really shouldn't. You know, if you're declaring bankruptcy, but then you go out and you're going to have a $75 per plate dinner with your brother and you're buying a new boat, I don't think you're really taking it that seriously. You're hiding some money somewhere. If we are really serious about this, and there's one question that I was going to ask Admiral Solansky that I didn't get around to, is the reducing administrative distractions great and all, but when are we, and I like the fact that we had an announcement that we're over a slow period of years for the rest of this decade, we're gonna ramp down from some of our flag billets. But what are we doing to look at our staff infrastructure and our shore infrastructure to consolidate, to reduce? You know, do in 2013, do we really need DESRONs larger than they were in 1995 with fewer ships? Why are they that big? What are they doing? How many layers on shore do we really need? I like what the Marines did. I think the Army did it as well back last decade, where they said, hey, I want you to tell me who is not deployed in the last 5 years. Yeah, I would like to know who is not deployed in the last 10 years. And what billets are they filling? And let's look there. And if we're going to do a reduction in forces, if you hadn't deployed for 10 years, shipmate, have a good day. Why? It broke my heart, some of the people I talked to who got hit by the SRB, ERB, MOUSC, all those damn things, coming back from an eight-month deployment, and then they're kicked to the curb. That's what I'd be interested to see. What are some efforts we're going to do to cut that overhead, to be able to repurpose that money? Because we aren't going to see more money. And you've heard me pontificate before. We haven't even begun the reductions in the amount of money that we're going to be allocated. We need to seriously, seriously make sure that we cut our fat before we start really cutting into our muscle. But a lot of these things are a little sacrosanct. We've had some of the people have emailed me and said, I've gone through my third sapper training in the last month. Was that really necessary? You know, who and how often did that take place in the fleet? How many man hours did that take place? Did that consume? Have we answered the mail? Are we going to keep answering the mail? That's it's very hard to say no. And I'm really looking forward to hearing a lot of people saying no to the point that we hear some complaining. I don't hear enough people complaining because people have said no to them yet.
Well, I'm on the Navy website, and there are 323,000 some odd active duty Navy personnel, 109,000, 110,000 Navy reservists, and 201,000 civilian employees.
Ding, ding, ding.
Yeah. I mean, if I were a czar, if I, you know, like the old Dr. Seuss books, if I were if I ran the circus or whatever, I'd be looking at civilian employees because I have no idea what, I mean, you know, you worked in different worlds than I did, but what did 201,000 civilian employees do?
And some of those are extremely well paid. You know, we were talking about flag officer reductions. I really want to see how many SESs we're going to be cutting and reducing, because I've worked with some pretty darn good SESs, but for every one that I thought was worth more than the oxygen he was absorbing, there were two that is like that episode of The Office. What exactly do you do here? You know, what value are you adding?
Well, it's 1,000 civilian employees for 285, I mean, you know, 1,000 per ship. For 285 ships, battle force ships, 200,000 civilian employees, you know, that seemed to me to be a really awkward ratio.
It's extremely awkward. Well, I tell you, I've been looking, you know, speaking of guests that we're going to be having, I've been looking for somebody to write something that about this very topic that I go, hey, that's a guy we got to have on Midrat. So I haven't been able to find that guy yet. So if you see that, let's talk about it. Maybe bring somebody on, because right now, when the subject comes up, I kind of feel like a blindfolded person throwing punches. I really am having trouble making contact on what is really going to impact everything that we do. And I don't get a warm fuzzy from what I read or what I see online, that somebody really, really has a sober, conscious view and a multi-step program to get where we need to go. Because we can hold our breath till we turn purple crying about sequestration, and we can all hope that the Army gets cut much deeper than we do. But that's not going to eliminate the fact that when you back up and look at it holistically about where the budget is, what our financial situation is, and the political support for military spending is, that the budgets aren't going to get a lot smaller, and people need to get ready for that.
Well, let's suppose you threw 100,000 sailors, you know, out of our 400,000 some. You take a 25% cut in the number of sailors, but you left the number of civilian employees the same. Would the Navy be capable of fighting a war? I mean, I'm curious about this, and I you're right. We need to find an expert, subject matter expert on this, and maybe they can explain to us why it's important to have all those people. So, you know, and a lot of them, I'm sure, do things for DARPA and then whatever the Navy equivalent of all that stuff is. But, you know, there's got to be, I mean, that 1,000 people per each ship is a lot of people, and I'm curious about it.
I like that figure. Plus, I think we've gone too far with the civilians, because you know what? If the if the outgoing material hits the rotary fan, you can always tap that YN2 on the shoulder, who's the executive assistant to the deputy's flag rider. Hey, shipmate, you're going to sea. Pack your bags. Get your wife. You're going. You tap GS-15 on the shoulder and tell him, you know, he's going to deploy. After he strokes out, you know, you're not going to be able to deploy. And so there's something to be said for having a little bit of flex there. Anyway.
Well, let's circle it back to the quote you had. Circle back to the Mahan quote you had, which is, you know, what some of these people do nothing, apparently, except just continue to try and justify their existence. And that is at the core of that quote.
Yep, it's that there is a quaint, well-worn story, which may be new to some readers, of an administrator who complained that his office was working it admirably until the war came and threw everything out of gear. And
exactly.
The habit. I also like that. The habit of the armchair easily prevails over that of the quarterdeck, as it is more comfortable. And speaking of more comfortable, what do you say we wrap it up? Hey, I wanted to give everybody a heads up. Happy Labor Day. We're having a best of next week, and we will follow that up. Our next live show will be on the 8th for episode 192. And we're going to have some of the folks responsible for the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum, which is being held the 12th through the 14th of October, I believe, in Chicago. People can look it up, DEF2013.com, Delta Echo Foxtrot 2013.com. And we will have them on to talk about what they're going to try to accomplish, what are some of the subjects, and we'll be off and running from there. Anything else you want to pass there, Eagle?
Until then, praise the Lord and pass the ammunition.
Amen. And thanks, everybody, for joining us. And we'll see you on the other side for another edition of Midwraps. Cheers.
Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.